Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.
Let's get this show on the road, shall we? Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Chris Sewell, who is Director of Engineering at Build Circle. It's great to have you join us today, Chris. I mean, thanks for taking the time to sit down with me for a little bit of time to have a bit of a chat, really.
Yeah, not at all. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Now, let's just dive in at the deep end, shall we? Let's get a bit of insight into Build Circle, if you can, and a bit of insight into your role, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with Build Circle. So Build Circle is a boutique consultancy. We've been running it for about 3 years now, I think maybe just over 3 years. And we predominantly work with software and tech companies of a few different sizes, mostly startups, but also some big ones as well, and some sort of household names such as Moonpig, you may have heard of. But yeah, we sort of do sourcing contractors and sort of high-end talent in software development. But also we do as a sort of a value add, some add consulting services as well, and sort of more specialist things. I joined Build Circle, I think it was probably just over 2 years ago, as head of engineering. Before that, I was a contractor for them, and I worked with a few of their clients. And then, I joined as a sort of full-time director. Yeah, and I think that's kind of it in a nutshell, really. We're quite small. I think we've just recently hired some permanent and full-time engineers, which is really exciting. You know, they started only last week, so there's now sort of we're getting pretty close to, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 I think employees, and then the rest are obviously contractors, like I said before.
I was just gonna say, it amazes me the power that, like, a relatively small team can have on business. I mean, like you were saying, you've got 7 or 8 people in your team, and especially in engineering, that can be incredibly powerful, can't it?
Yeah. So we're only a small team. We try to be like as lean as possible. And, you know, we stick to try and get the basics right and just stick to what we know. And you know, we're good at finding good people, and kind of building those teams and kind of you know, setting projects up and setting teams up for quality, I guess, and success. So that's kind of, you know, what we've been doing a great job at. We've worked quite a lot with Moonpig, and we've done we've had some really positive feedback from them, and then also with some of our fintech clients as well, which I can't name today, but they, one of them we've worked with from pretty much the very beginning, when they were founded, about 18 months ago. And it was just myself and 2 engineers. And then we sort of grew it from there to a team of about 7 people now. And pretty soon they're going to hire an additional sort of 2 teams of engineers through Build Circle, so they'll be a pretty big count, and they're what they're doing. Some of the work there is phenomenal. It's like a international payments platform, it's really, really exciting stuff.
Amazing. And I mean, I'm interested in yourself, Chris, and I want to find out about how you've navigated your career to get to where you are, because, you know, Director of Engineering is a pretty, you know, it's a special title. It's not everyone that, you know, can get to that level. So yeah, I'm just interested in how you've managed that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So it was sort of, it's a combination of a few different things. So I started out, it kind of started out at Just Eat, where I met and worked alongside Henry Keane and Tom Harris, who were also developers, team leads at Just Eat. And we worked together there for a while. I took a bit of time. So Just Eat bought a business in Australia called Menulog. I went to work there for a few months and took on a project there. And then when I came back, I think Tom, Henry and I had sort of taken a few, I guess, went off separate ways and went and did some other things. Tom is now, you know, the CTO of ClearBank, and Henry went to do become self-employed, and I also went down the path of being self-employed as well. And I worked, I sort of built a small agency and took on a few different clients, and had a lot of fun and learned an awful lot in doing that.
Yeah.
I worked with some very cool companies as well. Like, some of my clients were brilliant. I worked with this very creative company called Mouse that make like these indestructible phone cases. Cool. I worked on a very sort of different culture to Just Eat, but a lot of fun. And I built their sort of first e-commerce site when they were first starting out, and then yeah, I carried on being sort of doing contracts and sort of being self-employed for a while, and then eventually I think Tom and Henry founded Build Circle, and they started the agency up, and then I initially worked for them as a contractor for a few of their sort of clients working in regulated spaces. So this is some of it was finance, some of it was portfolio management, and some of it was sort of building apps for like the maritime industry, which is tanker ships and sort of international shipping and things like that. And then after some time, I think after probably about maybe a year and a half of doing that, they offered me a role as director. So it's a combination of sort of, you know, working very hard and kind of having a few wins with their clients, but also you know, I already knew Tom and Henry quite well from back in the day at Just Eat.
It seems like you've pretty much done everything you can imagine in terms of engineering.
You
know, you've worked for like startup, you know, it's just like you've done like everything. But I mean, what would you say is like the most important aspect of, I'd say, there's definitely a better word for this, but job hunting?
I think if I was a junior, like, it would be a place where there's a good mentoring culture. So there's a lot of pair programming. And, you know, I'm going to be given the opportunity to take on new responsibility. You know, perhaps there'll be budgets for training programs and maybe even certifications, if that's kind of how far I wanted to go. But the most important thing is a good mentoring culture and you know, being able to do a lot of pair programming. And I guess it kind of being a good environment to learn in. Not everyone is suited to just being thrown in at the deep end, at least not on the first day. So it's important that there's kind of engineers there that are happy to sort of teach as well. Not everyone kind of wants to do that. Not all sort of senior and principal engineers take that as part of their role, I guess, or job description to mentor juniors. But as a junior, I would look for that in particular. I think if you were like perhaps more sort of mid and lower senior, you'd want something where there's you know, some real challenges and opportunities to take more responsibility and probably look at building additional skill sets. So as a junior, you might just focus on application development. So that would be your sort of typical web stack or mobile development. But as you get closer to sort of mid and senior, you'd perhaps take more of an interest in the ops side of things and the or maybe release management or infrastructure and DevOps, and you'd sort of start to flesh out some of those additional skills, you know, take on configuring infrastructure or setting up monitoring and alerting and logging and things like that, and understanding more of the operational side of things. Or, you know, perhaps it's architecture and sort of get into making technical decisions. And I guess there are probably others as well. Perhaps security is one aspect, but essentially kind of building up additional skill sets outside of application development.
And I'm just thinking, you know, I know a few people who work in this space, and they seem to constantly be working outside of work.
Yeah,
on
sure.
Like either, you know, reading books or like learning new things or building their own apps. And I think that's such an important aspect to this space, essentially, because it's moving so quickly.
Yeah.
You've got to just stay this. I find the best way to stay on top of it would be to continually learn, I guess. Is there anywhere where you go for resources? Where do you look? Do you mean do you read books? Do you
conferences? So I guess I'll be honest, I don't have as much time as I would like to do this sort of stuff anymore. But yeah, I definitely, you know, there are certain topics I'm interested in that I'll take some time to read and listen to podcasts and things. It's, I guess there's so much out there and it's changing so much. You kind of can't digest it all. You do have to kind of pick and choose a little bit what kind of stuff you're going to learn about and what's of interest. But yeah, like I think, it's not always the case. Like not every company and role needs you to be that kind of, always on it kind of person, but it certainly helps. I think nowadays, if you're going to work for a big tech company, you know, in London or somewhere else with that kind of economy, then yeah, you do need, I think, you know, absolutely to be keeping on top of things, but yeah, pretty much the same answers as I think most people would give. It's, you know, Kindle books and podcasts and, you know, following some interesting people on Twitter and things like that.
There's a topic that I really want to find out about and I really want to discuss, which is data residency.
Yeah.
Could you, in a nutshell, tell us what data residency kind of exactly is?
Yeah, so data residency is where you've got to keep the whatever the data is that you have on your customers or users or the end client. There will be a requirement, like a regulatory or legal requirement, that means you have to keep the data of those users in the same country, the same geographic location as the users themselves, or the authority of those users. So in that comes up as a kind of a frequent theme with my sort of fintech client that I'm working with. But it's also, I think, a theme that's a subject that's going to come up with Thought River as I learn more with them. And yeah, basically you have to architect your application and your system around this kind of legal set of legal requirements. It's not as predominant in the US, I think, but in Europe, it's with GDPR, it's certainly more sort of strongly enforced. And in certain countries in APAC as well, it's the case that you have to architect your system this way. And yeah, so in a particular example, the fintech client I'm working for at the moment, you know, they're building an international payments, or they've built an international payments platform. And so they keep ledgers of transactions of you know, financial transactions for people that are residing in different countries, different legal jurisdictions, and they have to store those. You know, it would be nice architecturally if we could just store all of this ledger information centrally, but you know, for legal reasons we can't do that. So we have to essentially keep you know, several different ledgers for different jurisdictions, for different legal geographies, and you know, ensure that only the data that is concerned with the transactions of the people in that geography are in that ledger. And we have to kind of architect our system in a distributed way so that only the relevant data is in the relevant jurisdiction, basically.
Right. I mean, I don't understand why that's a legal requirement now. I mean, what's the...
Yeah, sure.
What's it protecting? I mean, there's probably something really simple there that I'm missing, but I can't get my head around it.
Yeah, so I think from the regulator's perspective, it's about privacy, and it's right. About so that there are concerns about, you know, the data being shared with other governments or other kind of foreign institutions. Okay. So they, you know, if in this particular example, if you're a UK bank, you know, the government will want UK bank financial information to stay within the UK. They wouldn't want a US bank or a US financial institution to be able to see that data. In the event that they need to do an audit or something like that, or there need to be some investigation, you know, they shouldn't be able to, other governments or other sort of organizations shouldn't be able to see the data. Now, I mean, whether that needs to be as strict as where the data is physically stored, as opposed to just kind of a configuration of access or permissions, is a different question. But yeah, as of today, where we are, the regulation is it has to be physically stored in the same country, so that, you know, the authorities, whether it's whoever in the UK, it'd be the police or some ministry, could access the data if they needed to, without having to go through another government or another authority.
You know, when you're building a platform for data residency, are there any system design considerations that you have to take into consideration, basically?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there's a couple of things on the sort of the ops side of things. Not, I guess it depends on who your cloud vendor is and lots of other things, but obviously not all regions are made equal. So some, you know, if we wanted to support a, like, for example, New Zealand, and we wanted to do transactions with New Zealand, some of the availability for or the sort of specs and what services the data center out of New Zealand can provide will be different to what we have in the UK. And that affects things like our availability and sort of service uptime, of our ability to provide the service and sort of deploy the international payments function to New Zealand. So we have to sort of consider, you know, those differences in some regions and data centers and how we kind of go about making sure we can still provide a reliable service in regions that have different kind of setups or different levels of reliability in their data centers and things like that. And then there's, you know, countries that are sort of very, very different or operate on a sort of very different level. So, for example, China is a whole other game, because that's, you know, if you work with any sort of cloud vendors that operate in China, so I think Amazon and Azure, and there's possibly others as well, you know, they almost operate as a separate business. So if you have your Amazon account for sort of the world and on all of the regions, and then if you want to deploy to China and run services in China, you almost have to set yourself up as a separate business just in China.
Oh, right.
And a separate Amazon account in China and things like that. And interconnecting services in and out of China, you know, presents some challenges there as well. Like they do a lot of monitoring and have sort of strict controls over network traffic and things like that. So that China is a very sort of unique region in that respect, and there's a lot of considerations you have to make there in supporting that, because obviously, and China's an example as well, they want all of their data to be resident inside of their borders. So to do that, we have to, you know, work with the conditions that they set, basically, which is very different to the conditions that other countries set.
Wow, God, there's so much to think about in this space. I mean, it can just go on and on and on, can't it, really? And it seems like it's a really kind of sensitive area. Like, you can't really get anything wrong. I mean, if you did, what would be the repercussions, like, legally? Do you know?
It would probably be quite, yeah, what would be the repercussions? Off the top of my head, I don't know. Like, I imagine, you know, it would be quite bad, quite challenging.
Yeah, it's not worth the risk.
If a government wanted to come and audit your data, you know, in the example of this fintech client, if they wanted to audit our transaction ledger and we didn't have the data, there would probably be, I imagine, considerable fines and consequences to that for the business, but also the customer's data as well. You know, if they have to go through another government to get their customer's data, or they've found that their information's been shared with a foreign business or foreign entity, you know, I mean, I if you recall Cambridge Analytica, you know, that sort of thing, then yeah, the consequences could be terrible, right? What someone could do with that, a foreign actor, bad actor, what someone could do with that kind of data, and the government's ability to sort of handle it and contain it would be limited if it was overseas. It does depend on the relationships. I mean, I imagine if it was the US, it probably wouldn't be much of a problem. I think my naive understanding of international politics is that the US and the UK probably get on quite well, so it's probably not such a big deal for the end users and customers. And I'm sure we'll get better with Europe.
Fingers crossed.
But further afield, it might be a different story. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is this, you know, these legal requirements, they're likely to continue to change, and then you'll have to keep, you know, amending how you work? Or is this kind of, this is it now for, you know, I don't know, a number of years?
It looks like it's going to get more and more, it's going to continue the way it is, basically, and it's probably going to get more and more restrictive, is my guess. Like, governments and are going to want to ensure that more data stays within their borders. It would be nice, purely just from a technical standpoint, sort of quite selfishly, if the regulations were loosened up and it would be, you know, easier to centralize data in these systems. But realistically, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, it's a really interesting space. I mean, I didn't know much about data residency, but it's really nice to like pick your brains about it, because it's really interesting. And yeah, I'll be interested to see where it goes in the future. I'm interested, Chris, in kind of your work ethic, I guess.
Right.
I just, you know, with engineers, it's kind of one of those roles that requires a lot of kind of deep focus, right?
Right.
So, how do you stay productive for long periods of time? Have you got any secret morning routines or anything?
Or
is it just loads of coffee like the rest of us?
I don't think there's anything secret. I don't know really is the answer. I mean, I think probably just the obvious things that anyone would say: try not to eat too much takeaway food. exercise, there's no sort of special formula, unfortunately. I'm not, you know, that I can give. I think I just try to sort of eat well, and I guess I kind of restrict how much time I spend on social media and sort of reading the news and sort of scrolling and stuff like that on websites. I tried to keep that to a minimum. But that's probably it. I don't think there's anything, there's no sort of morning routine, you know. I haven't got like a montage me doing, push-ups and like protein shakes or whatever, you know, drinking kale and stuff. Don't have anything like that, really.
It's not new, but there's a thing which people are doing, which is taking like a freezing cold shower first thing in the morning.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, actually, so I did used to do that. So occasionally I will do that. That I do find that's quite nice. I don't know. It's not a regular thing. I think it's just sometimes if I need to have a bit of a adrenaline hit in the morning, that helps sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. It's amazing. I used to do it more, but I mean, I do really rate cold showers. I mean,
yeah,
it's weird. After you do it for about a month, you actually really start to like enjoy it, like really enjoy it.
Yeah. 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 It's weird. You sort of, and then you try and make it colder. Because you get used to it, and then you sort of see how far you can push it. Yeah, I did sort of do that. I almost would try and see how long I could go without a warm shower, and it was a couple of days, I think. But experimenting with stuff like that can be fun.
Definitely. I just want to rewind time on your career, Chris, because it's been, you know, you've got a really interesting, like, career path and career history. So I'm just curious to find out whether, if you could go back to the start of your career, if there's anything you'd do differently the second time around.
I don't really like to think in terms of that too much because it's I can't change it anyway. It's what it is. But I don't think so. You know, there are small decisions and mistakes that I would have liked to have not made. But at the same time, you know, if I hadn't made them, maybe I wouldn't have learned something. So not really. You know, there's no kind of huge kind of glaring things, you know, that just maybe small things. But yeah. Sorry, don't have a good answer for that one. I think you know what's happened has happened. Like and there's not much point worrying about it. So it's just learn what you can, I think.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I mean it's difficult to answer that question when you're like you know really successful like yourself.
Right.
It's like everything's gone on, everything's worked out seemingly really well because you ended up where you are.
Yeah.
It'll be quite different if I asked that question for someone who wasn't where they wanted to be in their life, you know, and they had some right. regrets and things. But yeah, maybe I'll bin that question in the future.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's sort of because I'm definitely not perfect, like you know, yeah. and there probably are things, lots of things that I could have done better or differently, but I just don't really think about it, I guess, too much. I try not to dwell on it, but I'm sure there is an answer. If I sat down and thought about it, there probably is an answer in there.
Well, it seems to be that every time I ask this question on the podcast, I almost get the same response, which is like, well, I'm here now and it's all worked out okay, and you know I wouldn't really have done anything differently. That seems to be the way it is in
yeah.
you know, when people retrospectively look at their career.
It's not healthy to punish yourself, right? Unless it's a cold shower.
I always like to look, you know, I like any opportunity during this podcast for me to get philosophical. I absolutely
yeah,
will.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I could go into that now, but I'm sure you've got far better things to do rather than listen to me banging on about.
Let's go for it. Like, what kind of things?
Well, it's just something that I've been thinking about recently, which is like, it's the word if, and it's like,
right.
if you can, but it's absolutely yeah. fascinating. I mean, I know we've been in lockdown for a long time, and I'll probably listen back to this in 6 months and think, wow, I really did lose my mind then.
Yeah.
But if you take it back and you think about all the decisions that you've made and you think, well, if that didn't happen, then that wouldn't have happened. And then it's like a domino effect of all the, you know, seemingly small decisions at the time can actually translate into huge life moments, basically. And I just think that's something quite fascinating.
Yeah. It's a lot to think about, right? It's sort of quite intimidating to think about. Is that film The Butterfly Effect? I think that's.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Very good film about all the you know small kind of seemingly insignificant things can change the course of events massively. And it is. I guess. It's all part of like it's weird that like only it's only humans that think like that as well.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Yeah,
it's, animals don't worry about that. They just kind of do their thing, right? They just kind of you know, they just get on with it. And it's sort of it's part of our condition, I guess, to sort of relentlessly ask why and what if.
Yeah, I wish it wasn't. It drives me insane.
Yeah, that's it, right? It drives you crazy thinking about it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I've had too much time on my hands, and definitely today I've had too much coffee. all right, Chris. Well, I've really enjoyed chatting with you today.
Yeah, same.
I think that might wrap us up. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We've had a really interesting conversation. I've definitely got a lot from it. So thanks for taking the time to do this, Chris.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. It's been really good. And
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll catch up again soon, hopefully.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.